sea. For the devil sends the beast with wrath, because he knows the time is short. Let him who hath understanding reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. Its number is 666.
Roll for an issue of the podcast, issue number 67. This is going to be our Halloween special. As you heard with the different music at the beginning of the top of the show, I'm one of your hosts, DM Vince, sitting along with DM Nick.
Hello, this is not DM Nick. This is Count Blickenhaus.
Right, Count Blickenhaus. Bring Nick back over here.
I will drink your blood out of your neck like a icy fruit drink box.
Sounds like Count Chocula.
Yeah, I know. DM Will sitting in again.
Hello, I will speak normally.
As normal as you can, right?
I'll try.
And DM GM Matt.
Hello, everyone.
Well, we got a great show, so let's talk about first what we've been doing, what we've been up to, like we normally do. So, Matt, what have you been up to?
Well, my group started their Deadlands campaign, and we've so far been traveling up a riverboat on the Mississippi, and we've had a bunch of murders on the boat, people being skinned alive, and so we've been trying to attempt to solve that. My character's a giant fat man who, for some reason, keeps ending up naked wearing nothing but a gun belt. Haven't quite figured out why, but so far, so good. It's going to be rather interesting.
You always wind up naked?
Yeah, because we had a marshal on the ship, because there was a murder right before we left the Louisiana, and he's kind of on the run from the law, so he doesn't really like authority. So the marshal decided to come to his room, and my character happens to sleep naked, so he answered the door naked and just made the marshal interview him naked.
So you're playing a fat guy that sleeps naked?
Yes. Absolutely.
Now that's spooky.
That's a picture in my mind I just didn't need.
Yeah, I know.
Yes.
Jeez. I love Deadlands. I like that whole concept of how the weird wet west and the whole Civil War kept going on, and there's all that spooky crap going on.
Yes, and pretty in like the Texas Rangers and the Men in Black, and they're all like, "Oh, none of it's real." And the Dodge Times, which is like the equivalent of the Weekly World News, is actually the only newspaper that tells the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's definitely something we're having some fun with.
It's strange enough that I've actually started writing up, because I'm going to be running a Savage Worlds game myself, probably a zombie survival horror Walking Dead type thing.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I'll be running that for some people, because they asked me to run it. So I like Savage Worlds.
You might want to check out the game All Flesh Must Be Eaten, then.
Yeah, I really don't want to learn new mechanics.
It's really easy.
Yeah,
it's very easy, and they got some great stuff out there for that game. But I was looking for some zombie survival kind of thing. It's really good. But yeah, I know Savage World's great too.
Oh yeah, totally. I think both settings are really awesome, and I use a lot of elements out of the Deadlands material for Call of Cthulhu in case the players are going to, you know, the Wild West areas and so on. Yeah, great, two great systems.
So what about you, good old St. Nick, or Count Blah, or whatever?
Well, since I apparently sound like Count Chocula, I'm not going to do that anymore.
No, you can sound like that guy from Sesame Street who says, one peanut butter sandwich.
The Count? One peanut butter sandwich.
As everybody just stopped listening to the show.
Yeah, great. Yeah, with our iTunes just went down to zero. We're doing okay, I guess, as far as the gaming scene. We had our game 2 weeks ago. It went okay. I think we had too many people. I was DMing like 10, 11 people.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's way too many.
Yeah. It got kind of crazy. I generally like 8, maybe 9, the limit. But when you get about 11 people, it gets kind of nuts. It was really loud and everything. But I mean, it was okay. We kind of cut it short. We started kind of late anyway, but it was still fun. I'm looking to maybe this weekend with the kids and actually have them go to Ravenloft.
Ooh.
So we'll see how that happens. And and I went and saw The Thing on Friday night.
Oh, yeah? So how was it?
Awesome.
So then
incredible film.
So Will was right then. Okay.
Yes, it's fantastic. It is a prequel to the 82 John Carpenter film. And let me tell you, in my opinion, fantastic. It was really flawless.
Was Carpenter
involved with this?
You could
actually probably watch one movie and then the next one as like one long film.
Was John Carpenter involved in this one or no?
I don't believe so, no.
No, he wasn't, but the director of that movie is a huge fan of John Carpenter, and that director made it plain and clear that he was not trying to emulate John Carpenter's movie, because he said you cannot, you know, recreate or remake a great movie like his movie, you know, the 1982 version. It was a good movie. I loved it. It was awesome.
Yeah, I was like, after the film, I went right home that evening and watched the John Carpenter 82 film on Netflix. Anybody who's a fan of that film from 82 will enjoy this film.
Definitely. I just know Carpenter's had some Carpenter's had some real bombs lately, so I'm kind of leery about anything he's been doing lately.
But, you know, this one, definitely go out and see it for Halloween weekend. I mean, I highly recommend it to all our listeners.
Okay. And, Will?
Well, basically, as of yesterday, all gaming has been suspended until I move into my new house here, hopefully in the next 3 to 4 weeks.
Red alert.
Yeah, they all know what's going on, everything. And I think it's a good time to have a really good break. You know, the holidays are coming, so I think it's good for everyone to just take a little break for a while. And once I move in, you know, then we'll go back to gaming again. I joined a Drama Man's Leafs Skype game on Saturday evening. I'm playing a thief character, I mean, which is ironic because we talked about thieves last week. Oh. And he died like in 15 minutes of the game.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I failed the same throw versus poison. So, you know, it happens, and then now I'm playing another thief. So I'm trying to learn how to play that character. Like I said, I never played a character like that before. Well, I haven't played a thief in God knows how long. So it was actually pretty fun. And I will be running a first edition game, hopefully here in the middle of December, for another group of people. And that's going to be comprised of some of the members of the four groups that I run right now.
Isn't Leaf running B4?
B5.
Oh, he's up to B5 now. Okay.
Yeah, that's one reason why.
Which one is that one?
The Horror on the Hill?
Oh, okay. Okay. I know B4 is the Lost City.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And right. I didn't put the review online yet because I didn't want anyone that hasn't run through it to know all the good tidbits that's coming up later. So that's why I held off until he gets done with that. Then I'll continue doing my reviews.
We did a review of that on SOD, and we were like, there's so much room to run around and play in that module that you can't really spoil anything, so.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard both B4 and B5 are like that. You can actually expand those pretty well.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, very much so. I'm telling you, B4 is really a good module. I only had one complaint about it, and that was the desert scene where they, like, push you right into the main area after you find it. So, you know, but you know what? Any good DM will expand on it.
Yeah.
Cool. So we'll head into Sage Advice, if that's about it. Yeah. No stars this week, right, Nick?
No stars this week, but just to let you know, everybody out there, you want to give us star reviews, we'll read them no matter what. Just head on to iTunes, type in the search "Roll for Initiative," and you can link to us there where we have all of our previous episodes, and you could give us a review.
Okay, so Sage Advice.
Master, they're at the gates again. Master, it looks like another band of adventurers.
Adventurers again? Always the same. Coming to me for sage advice.
Sage advice. This is the sage advice. You're not going to sing with me, Nick?
I'm not feeling it. I'm not feeling it. No.
Fine, fine.
The sage advice! There we go.
Yeah.
Keep it in with the season, I guess.
There you go. It's the sage advice, Monster Mash.
There we go.
Well, we have a voicemail this week, and guess who it's from?
Let me think. Who gives? Lass?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, you finally got it right.
Okay.
So let's play that for you now.
Hi, this is Lass, and I have a question for the RFI podcast. One of the most iconic images that you get in fantasy novels is the idea of wizards having duels. You get it in Harry Potter, don't hate, as well as perhaps even Gandalf facing off against Saruman. So how would you adjudicate it without doing a round-by-round fireball versus fireball sort of paradigm that would blow up the entire wizard's tower? I'd love to hear what you guys would have to say on this. Thanks, and cheers.
Well, who wants to take that one? Magical duels.
Okay, we wouldn't do it fire by fireball. Fireball by fireball. No way. Lightning bolt by lightning bolt. There we go. Just kind of mix it up there. Kind of. Okay, maybe that won't work. I don't know. I'm kind of stuck on this one. Will, you got anything?
Well, to be honest with you, I have seen a couple scenarios, you know, that for a future edition, for a later edition of D&D, that, you know, that gives some rules and specifications on how to do duels like that and everything. But, you know, I have never, ever had come across a scenario where, you know, we had two magic users, you know, duking it out. It's not like psionics. Where with psionics, I mean, you could do it like psionic, you know, attacks or combat when you just write down the ability or the spell on a piece of paper, you turn it over. But see, initiative, that's the issue and everything is initiative. I really, this is a stumper right here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the closest I ever came to something like that, if I recall, I think the players are going through, I want to say against the Giants, that series. And there was the final section where they're in the Fire Giants and they run up against the Drow and everything. And there was something close to a Wizard's Duel, but the player character who was playing the magic user, he tends to like to fight more than use magic from time to time. And he just said the heck with it and used his magical staff and beat the heck out of the Drow with his staff.
What I can tell you is that I will look through the Dragon Magazine archive and the White Dwarf Magazine archive, and I will look through some more information as far, and I will post that under a topic on the website if I can find anything that covers specifically magic user duels and what have you. Yeah, that's something that is that's really a tough one there, because I don't think there's any rules as far as I'm concerned. There are no rules in first edition for magic duels that I know of.
No, they're not the official rules. You know of any Matt or Vince?
No.
Oh,
then go blow by blow and do it.
Yeah, I would go blow by blow.
I mean, that would be the simplest thing to do. And last, I don't think any of us really hate Harry Potter series. My kids love it. I know my oldest. So don't worry about that.
I thought the last movie. I'm not a big fan of Harry Potter. Don't get me wrong. I like how the story goes, but that last movie was pretty interesting. I liked the wizard duels with the wands and so on. But again, I think with the issue with a magic user duel, a wizard duel, however you want to say it, is that first, you know, it has to be done just how they do with psionic combat. You're going to have to use 3x5 cards. You have to figure out initiative segments and all that other stuff, and I think that's the best way of adjudicating a magic user duel. Who's going to get their spell off first? Well, let me tell you something. I'm casting magic missile every opportunity I can.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. I mean, I don't I can't recall right now how quick of a spell that is, but that's a very quick spell. And if you disrupt...
One segment, if I recall.
I think it's close to it, yeah. I mean, and if you disrupt the other person's spell, then that might give you the opportunity, depending on when you roll initiative. So this is where a DM is going to have to come up with a set, you know... I had to set the parameters on how would he do a wizard duel. That's an interesting question.
Cool. Yeah, I would just, I don't know. Yeah, that sounds good.
Sure.
Yeah, that sounds about good. If you want
I'm looking forward to hearing other people's responses on that.
Yeah, I have to throw it out to people out there how they do duels, so. 865-4210, area code 570 is our hotline.
Hotline,
where kobolds and... Now, we'll say dragons are standing by right now.
Wow, we've really stepped up in the world.
Well, you know.
We're dragons?
I found some extra gold and, you know, I bribed some.
Well, we're all out of Electrum pieces, huh?
We're saving those for you.
Thanks.
We gotta pay you with something, Nick.
Hey, cool. I like Electrum.
Cool. Fake Electrum. No. We have no other emails, rfistaff@gmail.com, so you can write in there. And let's head into table matters.
Yeah, I remember back in the day, a fella knew how to judge a fireball on the fly and how far the cleric could push the undead he turned. I tell ya, with all these min-maxers and munchkins, metagame and power game, there's something missing that I'm here to learn ya. Now sit down and crack your book while I commence to teach ya some.
Table manners.
Okay, good afternoon there, DMs and players out there. Today we got table manners, and we are going to talk about role-playing in the lands of Barovia. So I did a lot of research on this, and from personal experience as a DM, I ran I-6 Ravenloft almost a good 36 to four dozen times over the last 20 years or so.
Wow.
So, oh yeah, I know this module up and down. There's nothing. I dream about it sometimes. I think that's scary enough.
Okay, that's a little
stop
much.
Right there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that for a DM, the DM is going to have to make a decision, you know, where is he going to put Ravenloft or where is he going to put Barovia? So let me get off the module for a second. Let's talk about Barovia itself. Being that this is a first edition module, it was pretty much designed for you to take this town, put it somewhere in whatever setting you're using, and then, you know, you can do the and launch from the launch pad right there. Now, in the case...
Wherever you want.
Yeah, that would be the best thing because we're talking about first edition. We're not going to future editions like second edition. That's the whole purpose of Barovia is to put it somewhere in, you know, in your world campaign setting. Now, there's nothing to say that, you know, the mist that surround Barovia can actually, you know, reach out over the continent from the other side of the continent to grasp those players and then pull them all the way back over there to Barovia. So it doesn't have to be something local. It could be something long distance, maybe on another continent. You know, that's up to the DM. I think that's one of the important things. Where are you going to place Barovia? Another thing that a DM has to consider, and guys, you can interrupt anytime you want to.
I was just thinking, like if we're talking first edition AD&D and where the land of Barovia could be, there's a few ideas. At least one that jumps into my head is, I know if I was going to put it in the World of Greyhawk campaign setting, it would probably, I would think I would put it somewhere like in the Crystal Mist Mountains or the Hell Furnaces around there. Put it in like a little an offset niche within the mountains, a small valley. So maybe it's like a little principality or it's a barony. Right? It's a barony.
Yeah. Well, it's a small little thing. It's only a population of 500.
Right. So it's like its own like small little principality. It's a barony and part of a larger kingdom. So I have had this concept, if you're going to use something like that, like in an established game world, it just seems that Barovia, surrounded by mountains in a valley or something of that nature, and then you have the mist in the mountains and then you can wander in and maybe there are some legends from in the kingdom. Well, if you wander into this barony when the mist is around, you'll never come out alive, or no one ever comes out, something like that.
You might leave it undead, though.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's another plot hook too. But
right.
I don't like Forgotten Realms. Gosh, I'm trying to think of some of the names of some of the mountainous areas in the Forgotten Realms. I can't think of any. So
One thing that would help, just to let you know how Barovia is, the land itself now, and I'm going with various descriptions from, you know, all editions and everything, and all of them have pretty much ascertained that Barovia is it's very cold. The winters are very brutal. Yes, it's very mountainous around most of Barovia, and there's also a lot of dense forest. You know, great, you know, scenery, great environment for wolves and those kind of beasts, you know, big bears and all that kind of stuff. So there are very hardy people that live in Barovia, and it is also ascertained that they speak with a Romanian accent, and so again, it comes down to it, how will the characters communicate with these people if you decide to use, you know, foreign languages, whatever the case may be.
Yes, you run into the townsfolk and they say, "Beware of the wolves out in the woods. Do not go to the woods in the night." Stuff like that.
Or you can always use the Dracula Dead and Loving It thing when she kept going, "Goodbye."
No. Wrong.
Oh, come on, that was funny.
Right, that's good. I forgot about that part. But no, Barovia is a great place to explore. Now, when DMs look at I-6, I mean, they don't give a lot of detail. They just, you know, give just a map of Barovia and the surrounding area. And I believe that the scale of the map, it wasn't that much, actually.
No.
I'm just trying to see where the scale's at. They don't have a scale on this, which is unfortunate. I forgot what the scale.
One hex is 200 feet.
Yeah, yeah. One hex equals 200 feet. So they don't give you too much.
No. So you're probably getting maybe a half mile by a quarter mile area.
Well, looking at the map with the town, I mean, it's big enough that you can explore it.
Oh, yes, definitely. But you know what? Being that it's a module and it's only, you know, on this location, I would probably expound upon the map, expand it a lot more, maybe like a 5 mile or maybe 10 miles, and have them further out, deeper in the woods or further, you know, deeper in the mountains, something. So as they travel to Barovia, you know, they start encountering, you know, weird things and so on, just to get them a feel for the land. So we're trying to make this a spooky kind of setting. So, you know, you want them to go. I don't know if any of you have been to Washington State. You see how the weather here is very gloomy. There's a lot of fog. It's cold. It's kind of miserable.
I actually got the impression from the module, and I think even back then when I read it, and when we had Tracy on a couple of times, I think the impression was this was kind of like a one shot. Mm-hmm. This was like the one shot you do for the Halloween game, you know? And that's how initially I think this module was intended.
Right.
After that though, because it became such a great hit for TSR, you know, it was like, hey, you know, we got this module, Ravenloft, and everybody raves about it. It's great. Let's do a sequel. So
the I-10 was born.
Well, okay. But you know what I mean? It's like, what was it intended is a one-shot, but... And then I think that was some of the frustration was like, is there more to it? People want more.
Right.
Yeah, so... And in a way, that was kind of a good thing, because... It could leave it up to the DM if he wanted to expand on it on his own.
Yes. I enjoy I-6 is my favorite, you know, first edition module. I really love it. But other things that we could discuss also was like tips for DMs to bring players into the mist.
Oh yeah.
Like starting at level one.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Yeah, this is like a lower end version of Tomb of Horrors then.
Well, this is where the idea of actually expanding the territory before they get fully into the mist. Maybe they start running into slightly more aggressive wolves. Maybe
more of a mini campaign kind of thing.
Right. And as they get closer and closer to the mist, the creatures get a little tougher. All of a sudden, there's less people. The only thing they keep running across are gypsies.
And why couldn't they go to the town of Barovia? I mean, why not? You could play that whole town as, you know, a depressed town with all these gypsies and people that are just so scared of everything. And
right,
you could do that too. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of additional first edition material out there, and I want to say it was reference 5. I can't remember the thing for the life of me, which the whole book is just, you know, small mini adventures that deal with undead. You know what? It's one of them. I know it's reference 5, and you see an undead creature in the front, but it deals nothing but mini adventures with all undead, starting with skeletons, zombies, ghouls. Yeah, and this works all the way up to the, you know, to the lich eventually. Mm. But I mean, we wouldn't have the players that high because Ravenloft starts off as a 5th level module for first
Lords
edition.
Lords of Darkness.
That's it, Lords of Darkness. Thank you, my friend. And that is a great tool right there to, you know, inject that into the Barovia campaign. I mean, there's a scenario for a cemetery that would fit perfectly in there. So there's lots of ways.
Kind of a side note that you mentioned. Yeah, it's the module's level 5-7.
Uh-huh.
Fighting a vampire? Really?
Fighting a vampire who's a 10th level magic user?
Yeah.
Oh.
Thank you.
They did revamp it. They did revamp it on the second edition anniversary for higher levels, so.
Yeah. The thing is, you got to understand, though, that you're not, you're fighting a tough guy. I mean, he is really nasty in there. But, again, I know if I should tell you some of these things, but you know what? I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway. I don't care. Especially in the crypts. In the crypts down there, when you're starting to close in on where hopefully his lair is, it all depends on what the gypsies tell you. In one of those crypts, there is a +1 luck blade with 1 wish left.
Yes.
I'm telling you. If the players do it right, and you know what? There's other magical things. There's the sword in there. There's that
Sunblade. Yeah.
Yeah, the Sunblade. I mean, there's enough stuff there to help you defeat Strahd. You just got to do it right. Now, if the DM is weak and makes the vampire weak, well, then it's no big deal. But let me give you an idea. I know that when I played it one of the first times, his crypt was where he was going to be hiding at, and it's down there. The only way you can get into that room, you have to go through one of those crypts there because it served as a teleporter.
Yeah.
And so what happened was, is as the players opened it, they said, oh, this looks like a teleporter, or they figured some way with a teleporter. The vampire knew where they was at. So what he did was, he's a magic user, he cast fireball through his end, so it went through the teleporter, hit the players, as they were outside deciding whether to go in, who was going in first. So they make their saving throws, they take the damage, they said, oh no, we can't do this, he's in there. So they all rush in there to go, you know, bum rush him. However, he goes in gaseous form, goes over their head, goes through the teleport, then he's on the other side while the players are in. See how? You got to play him very intelligently.
Right.
Oh yeah.
But you know what? With that +1 luck blade, if that doesn't help you defeat the vampire, you know what? Let the vampire kill them all, make them all vampires out of spite.
Yeah.
So how would be a several good ways, like if you were going to do this as a mini campaign, you know, how would this, how would you play that out? Well, I mean, I'm kind of curious on that.
Well, you know, that's the difficult part because I have to look at it and think what kind of group I'm playing with. If I wanted to do it as a mini campaign, I would probably have to come up with some, I would make the players either Barovian or make them descendants of Barovia, you know, that lived elsewhere.
I did this with the Book of Sorrows. I took half the campaign, the second half of the campaign was all Ravenloft based. The players just didn't realize it at first, but I just warped everything and made everything just really weird.
Nice.
But there was different moons and they would change positions and colors and then people acted strange and like people would hide during the daytime and things. They had to figure it like
and the players were like, "What's going on?"
And they'd walk somewhere and
that awesome feeling?
Yeah, they'd walk somewhere and wouldn't realize where they're walking.
Muddle your players.
No, I say that's a great idea. I mean, that's the first thing you tell the characters as they're making characters. And they say, like, well, where we're from. I said, we will discuss that later. First, let's make the characters. Let's decide the character classes and from that, and have them start maybe in another city in the lands of, well, in Barovia, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, Ravenloft, as we might want to call it. And they start there in another city because, you know, when it comes down later on, you notice that Barovia has a couple other cities, much larger populations of 2,000, 3,000, something of that nature.
Oh, I had them go through what I had called the Dark Woods or the Spooky Woods. And when they came out of the Spooky Woods, it was a totally different land. That was their transition over to my Ravenloft.
That's perfect. That's perfect. Yeah. All that will work, you know. And, you know, it's up to the DM to decide how he wants to bring the players into the mist. And, you know, another thing that would be great is, let's say a player commits a transgression that would probably consider an alignment shift, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Instead of making that alignment shift, now the mist have noticed that particular person and the group that's with them, and that's what grabs them into, you know, to Ravenloft.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, yeah. I just thought of another thing. When you're talking about the mist,
mm-hmm.
think of, like, The Mist, like Stephen King.
Yes, the movie.
Remember that? Mm-hmm.
With the bugs?
Wouldn't that be a great way of, like, having, like, I mean, strange tentacled creatures living in the mists?
Yeah.
That would be, ooh, yeah. Ooh, spooky. Ooh, scared myself.
And then have the party, the whole entire party kill themselves except for one person and, like, the government saves the day. Oh, never mind.
Well, yeah, that was, I love that film.
That movie was scary. That movie was scary.
Feel good movie of the year.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. But so, no, see, the big question is that once you get them in the mist, and one of y'all mentioned it already, how do they get in? Or how do they get in? How do they get out?
Well, it's like a Roach Motel. You never get out.
Yeah.
Well, if I remember correctly, you have to defeat Strahd and the mist goes away. That's the only way you're going to get out.
Right. Unless you can get a gypsy to give you the potion that lets you...
There you go. Yep.
Right.
And take the right amount of drops
inside
the cave so you don't end up in, like, you know... Never mind.
But, yeah, so the DM has to devise all these ways and everything, and there's so much available. It's just imagination is the only thing that's going to stop you from making this a great game. I mean, this is really a great opportunity for a DM to be, I wouldn't say vindictive or hateful and everything, but make it a very difficult, you know, a quandary as far as how, you know, to get in and how to get out.
No, I like vindictive and cruel. I think that would work.
Yes.
Well, just like that Skype game where my thief got killed in 15 minutes, I think, like, that was cruel. I can't wait till I run something because I'll make sure I remember that. But yes, you know, yeah, and I-6, yes, if you defeat Strahd, that is one of the ways of getting out. Or like just as Matt said, you know, the Vistani, the gypsies there also have ways of transversing the mist and everything. So it just depends on the DM on how cruel he wants to be and how hard he wants to make it, how easy he wants it to be.
Well, you know, we're talking about, like, basically kind of making the one module and how you can expand it into a mini campaign. Well, you know, we were kind of preparing show notes and stuff for this. One of the articles from Dragon Magazine I remember is by Leonard Lakofka, and I got in my Best of Dragon Volume 2, but the original issue was October 1979. Number 30, it's called Good Evening. It's all about vampires and how Lakofka runs vampires.
Now. Say it right.
Lakofka, right?
No. The Good Evening.
Good Evening. I do not think. Why? But he has a really good section here. It really breaks down just how the vampire is in the AD&D game, because he makes no bones about it. This is not a Bram Stoker vampire, because, you know, vampires touch you and you get level drained. They don't have to suck your blood.
I'm eating chicken, I'm drinking wine.
That's right.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Drink you like a high seed through food drink box. But he has stats for lesser vampires. Basically, people who have been turned into vampires by a regular standard greater vampire. And I think that would be a real good thing to have for a Ravenloft campaign, is, you know, not, you know, being, you know, Strahd being the big baddie, but he also has other lesser vampire minions. And I think that would be a real good article to refer to and maybe help, you know, kind of flesh that out a bit.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And you're going to run into a couple of those lesser vampires in there. I believe there were female vampires. I don't know how many there were. But also know that Strahd is also some type of, how would you call it? He's like a necromancer, kind of. Because he does have his, he created some of his own undead, like the Strahd zombies.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the Strahd zombies.
Wait, so, I mean, yeah, definitely. I mean, just, I mean, take this guy and use him. I mean, you know what? Don't use him. Abuse him. Abuse his abilities.
Yeah, he's a vampire/10th level magic user.
Or if you're reading I-10, he becomes an alchemist at one point.
Yeah, well,
right.
We would just let that go.
Hey, it's part of it's part of the canon of Strahd, so.
Yeah.
Well, I know, I know.
It's like Highlander 2.
And 3.
Highlander 2 did not happen.
It's more like Halloween 3. I don't know why it happened.
Yeah. Good. Yes. Watch the pumpkin.
Hey, let me tell you something. I do like Halloween 3. I really liked it. I mean, yes, it didn't have nothing to do with Michael Myers, but I'm going to tell you, Halloween 3 is a Call of Cthulhu. I mean, that episode, that's exactly what that is. Oh, definitely. Anyway. The Witch. I love that.
Let's get back on track.
Three more days
of watch the magic pumpkin.
Three more days of Halloween. Silver Shamrock.
Silver Shamrock.
You know how many people were disappointed when that movie came out? They're like, where's Michael Myers? And that's why that movie flopped.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
But back on Ravenloft and Barovia and everything, they based the town, the surrounding environment of that of most of some of the cities they're based in Transylvania, which people don't know it does exist. There was an actual Transylvania.
And it's not actually, in Pennsylvania.
The Carpathian Mountains are still named that. Am I correct?
Yeah. Yes. It's a region in Romania.
And let's clarify now, don't anybody say it's in Pennsylvania. I can't stand those jokes.
Romania. Pennsylvania is kind of creepy.
Hey.
I have to watch out now because my grandmother's Romanian, so I have to question her sometimes.
She'll give you the evil eye.
Yeah, well, when she talked, let me tell you something about my grandmother. She's 112 years old.
Wow.
And, Shut up. Really?
Yes, she is. My parents are in their 90s, and my grandmother's 112. And she told me back in the day that when radio came out in Romania, they thought it was evil spirits coming from a box.
Wow.
And now my mother, who is 92 years old, back then they used a lot of chalk back then. My mom liked to chew on chalk, and so her mom would tell her, you know what chalk is made out of? It's made out of dead people's bones. So my mom was always terrified of chalk.
Wow.
So, a lot of my mom's family and part of my dad's family is from that Eastern European side of the house and everything.
12, really?
Yes, sir.
Should get her on the show.
Well, I would have to translate for and everything because she speaks Romanian and Hebrew, so that'd be very difficult. And then we can call a vampire countess or, whatever.
Well, my great aunt on my mother's side is 104, so it's possible.
It's amazing stuff out there, I tell you. But I love Ravenloft, Barovia. DMs, take advantage of it, expound upon it, expand it. Make it your world. Make it spooky. Add in all those elements. The environment is the most important thing. Make it. What was that movie where the sun never came out because they had some invention and the clouds came and covered the sun and the world was in darkness? Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was Highlander 2. We don't talk about it.
Okay, we won't talk about that. But that's what this is what Barovia is about. It's always gloomy. The sun rarely comes out. It's cold. It's miserable. And you want to impress that feeling upon the players that not only is it miserable because it's on their skin, but their soul as well. They're always cold. They're always chilly. You know what I'm saying? No matter how much you put wood on a fire, you still feel cold. You know, like you have a bad flu or something like that.
Yeah.
You feel drained. Even though you slept for 12 hours, you still feel tired. You just feel the land drawing your energy away from you. You have to impress that upon the players. It makes
them
feel
winter
like
in Northeast Ohio where I live.
But that's the whole point, though. You know, the animals are always sickly looking. You know, you see more rats out than normal. The people are always grimy looking, dirty. Whatever the case may be. You just got to instill that foreboding feeling.
You're talking about Connecticut now. Oh, sorry.
Oh, good job. There goes our Connecticut demographic. Good job.
Hey, I lived here for 10 years. I'm allowed to say it.
Okay, that's cool.
So I guess that's pretty much it. Expand upon it. Use it. The land is... They have a map there. Just make it bigger, like Nick said. Make the hexes 1 5 miles and move the land inwards a little bit and add more foresty areas for the players to explore and set up missions for them to run around in the forest. And there's plenty of monsters you can use.
Oh, heck yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's too many. And that's another thing. Make them go through the woods. I mean, use everything possible. I mean, scarecrows, you know, living things, you know, evil trance. I mean, whatever you can. The land is twisted. It's contorted.
Rats of unusual size?
Oh, yeah.
New York City rats.
Definitely.
And you know what, Nick? There's a whole set of dark Pokemon you can use for this.
Oh, God. No, it isn't so.
Yep, there is the evil dark Pokemon.
Oh, we'll have to do a Pokemon in AD&D episode at some point.
I will be absent for that one. Thank you very much.
No. Oh, no, no.
I will let Vince have it. Vince, that is your show. I'll let you talk your head off.
I'm going to give you notes, and then when you should at least show up, we'll start recording and be like, this episode is going to be about Pokemon.
I actually have a friend who... used to work for Pokemon USA and wrote for Pokemon magazines, and he is an AD&D player, so I do know someone.
Oh, it's his fault.
No, we'll have to talk to him. We'll have to talk to him.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Final thought, Nick, you got to catch them all.
like a virus, catch them all.
Game mechanics coming up next.
Oh man, what the heck is that?
Stand aside, you fool! I have a spell that will work here!
What do you mean I can't hit with that? Oh, right, fine. Show it to me in the book.
Welcome. Game Mechanics.
So for Game Mechanics, we're going to talk a little bit about running gypsies in your campaign, or the Vistante, or pretty much just any type of gypsy.
The Romani.
The Romanis?
Romani. They are gypsies in Europe. They are a Romani stock.
Well, I was talking about the Vistantes from Ravenloft, the race.
Oh, yeah, them too.
Yeah, them too. Now... Just talking about gypsies in themselves, a good example of a perfect gypsy to use in Ravenloft is, you seen the movie Drag Me to Hell?
Yes.
Yes!
That old woman in that movie is a perfect example of a gypsy that would be in Ravenloft.
Ugh.
What about Thinner?
Yes, Thinner is another good example. If you doing research to play gypsies, a lot of people have a problem playing gypsies. Watch these movies, and you'll get a great idea of how gypsies run.
The old crone that lives down at the end of that road.
Now, there's two different types of gypsies that can trick players. There's the old crow, like we see in the Thinner and the Drag Me to Hell movies. And there's also the pretty, you know, gorgeous one that lures you in with her, what do you call, prowess of womanhood.
Her womanly wiles.
Yeah.
Yes.
And she's the sneaky one.
That
yeah,
she is.
You have to be careful of those ones. But how do you get your players... I guess the first thing is how to get your players involved with a gypsy. You kind of have to coerce them into getting involved with a gypsy, because most players will be suspicious of everything. Especially if
actually, one way I could think of is maybe for one of the characters' player background, I think would be work perfect for a thief, is the thief, his family were gypsies. I think that would be work good. Maybe they bump into his family once in a while, you know?
Yeah. I've got players involved with gypsies, like, in bars, like, they're accidentally, you know, pushing into a gypsy, or not helping an older woman, and then the older woman cursing them because, you know, they were too stubborn to help her.
Oh, I just remembered there was a Dragon article about gypsies, the Gypsy Caravan. I'm trying to remember which issue of Dragon it was.
Hmm.
Oh, darn it.
To get the players involved in, say, the fortune-telling aspect of I-6... Because in the beginning, you're supposed to deal the cards out yourself, or roll the cards up yourself and predict the way the module is going to go. But you can also get the players involved to change where everything's going to be in the module.
So, I like using the actual playing cards.
Yeah, playing cards are pretty cool to use, and you just take out the numbers and just use the suits, that's all.
It's just most like most of the suits.
Yeah, just the face cards. To get the players involved, you have to kind of coerce them. Is like, you see these people all around, an ancient gypsy woman in her tent, and people are running around screaming, going, yeah, and get them excited, you know, kind of trick them to go into there. Get them to at least look, and then you get them to, like, get their cards read. I've done those type of methods. Have you guys done any type of methods of getting players to work with gypsies? Anyone?
Well, like I said, maybe one of the player characters, preferably a thief, maybe background as a gypsy. Or maybe, like, as gypsies are nomadic people, maybe the town that the party is currently in, maybe... a gypsy caravan is parked outside of the edge of the town, and maybe they're setting up like a small carnival, because, you know, and you have the fortune teller there, and you got maybe a guy who's like the sword swallowing, the whole shebang. Maybe that's another way that the player characters could get involved with the gypsies there too. Just a couple ideas.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, and I found the article for the Gypsy Train. It's in Dragon Magazine number 93, page 43.
Okay.
Cool.
Number 93. It's in my collection. I'll have to look at that again.
Yeah, so, you know, we talk about gypsies, and this is where the Lords of Darkness, I believe that's what it was called, right, Matt?
Yes.
That was reference 5, am I correct? Is it REF 5?
Yes, it is reference 5.
See, now this is where... you get the gypsies involved, where maybe one of these undead creatures, somewhere, you know, you just pick one out of the book and everything, has that deck of cards. They stole that deck of cards from the head gypsy lady or whoever's doing the fortune telling. Yeah. And so, you know, they say, listen, you help us get the cards back, then we will give you a free, you know, fortune reading or, you know, whatever reward the DM wants to impress upon the players and everything. So again, you know, so you see how you can, you know, grab other resources and that, you know, that mini campaign that Nick was, you know, kept referencing. That's just another thing that could be inserted into I6 instead of just getting them straight into, you know, the Barovia, then straight into the castle after they meet the dead Burgermeister's daughter and all that other good stuff. I love how they did the reading, the Fortunes of Ravenloft. I thought that was an awesome concept.
Yeah,
I just wish they. Yeah, and I wish they had. I wish they had an actual. What do you call? How do you say it? Tararoka deck.
Tarot deck. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you say those things? They spell them different. I see tarot deck, and I see a tararoka, or whatever they call it. And you know, for later editions, they did come out with an actual deck like that, and how to convert it over. And I think it's awesome. And let just put the cards in front of the players. Let the players actually pull the card out and lay it out. I mean, I think it's great.
Didn't White Wolf or maybe Steve Jackson's games do a tarot deck? Someone did a tarot deck somewhere along the lines.
I have posted pictures of them, and there was two releases of them, and I believe I put them online. They're really nice decks. If you all can get them, let me tell you, get them.
Who made them?
Because they're out of print, and they're very rare.
Who made them?
I want to say it was Sword and Sorcery.
So White Wolf, okay.
Right, because there was a deck that came with the second edition box sets, and then White Wolf released their own under the Sword and Sorcery label for third edition.
And that one is the one I want. I want people to really get that one. It's out of print, but get those because they're real nice and they're dedicated to Ravenloft. They're really good looking cards. I posted a link somewhere on the forum and showed them, you know, about people what they look like.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they were pretty nice looking cards. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah, they had that yellowed look, that aged look. You know, like they've been used. Oh yes, great cards. I made. You know what? As a matter of fact, I'm gonna go down this week and see if I can pick some up in case someone's looking for them.
I definitely can use them for my games. I'll send you money for those, definitely, if you could find me a pair.
Yeah, because I don't think I'm going to find them anywhere except in gaming stores or, you know, I'll just have to take my chance on eBay and take a look. But, yes, if any DM that plans on dealing with Ravenloft and dealing with this deck of cards, yeah, get those. They are awesome.
Yeah.
So yeah,
Something else you could do with your players is before they get into the mist, but they see the mist, they see the gypsy caravan coming out of it. So that way they get the impression, oh, if we go through the mist, that means we can leave, no problem.
Huh. Little do they know.
Exactly. So that way it's just like, okay, it's just a real thick, heavy fog. People are leaving it. They seem okay. And then they get through it and they're like, why can't we leave? And they just see these gypsies leaving. So that's another way. Then they can start trying to talk to them. How are you able to leave? And at which point they just try to sell them a bunch of junk.
What do you guys think about a gypsy class for first edition? Because they have basically a write-up of the gypsy is an NPC. Well, I picked up I-10 by accident. Ah! let me put that down.
Burn it!
Yeah. They have a, what is it, the madam, they have a kind of a write-up of her spells and how she would act and things. What do you guys think of maybe letting a player play a gypsy in another type campaign?
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, I didn't really look up the subject too much of that, and that's my fault for doing that. But no. I know that in White Dwarf, I'm certain there was something that was related to gypsies there, or maybe it was a Dragon magazine. But yes, definitely. Gypsies, well, you know, it's funny. Nick brought it up that it would be like a thief-based character. I'm going to be careful not to offend any real gypsies out there because we know that they get a bad rap these days and everything. So maybe they might be more, it's hard to say, clerical. They might be more magic user. I don't know.
They're almost bardish. Because
yes.
Yeah, I could see like within like a gypsy caravan you would find thieves, bards, magic users.
Yeah.
With their fortune telling powers, I believe would be more clerical in nature, but then again, I guess it depends on where they're getting their readings from or whether it's from an arcane source or a more divine source. Probably more arcane then probably, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, wow.
I don't know. I don't know if there is a gypsy NPC class.
I think I remember seeing one in one of the magazines.
I just found another article in Dragon about gypsies. It's in issue 59. Gypsies, a blessing or a curse or both. And it just goes into the history of gypsies, gypsy legends, and fortune telling. It actually has rules for fortune telling. Using a dice. So
cool. It's
rather interesting. So I'll put links to that in the show notes.
All right. Cool. So I guess that pretty much wraps up a gypsy. Let's hear from the people out there what they think about gypsies. Nick, you have anything to add?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Head into creature feature next.
That is not it. Which can eternal lie, and with strange ears, even death may die.
I welcome the unwary to the Creature Feature Theater.
And now we are at the Creature Feature Theater. And excuse me as I put on my rubber gloves before, as I pick up this module, the much maligned I-10. Oh, I-10.
Ravenloft 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Oh, yes. Nick.
Ravenloft 2, The House on Griffin Hill.
The Destruction of Jared Sin. No.
Outlined by Tracy and Laura Hickman, contrary to what the cover may lead you to believe. It was actually written by 6 people because Tracy and Laura decided to leave TSR during the middle of writing it. And TSR proceeded to rush it out. Hence why it seems disjointed, because it actually is disjointed.
Yeah.
But we're not going to talk about the module. We're actually going to talk about one particular creature in it. And that is Asselin. He is the lich who has teamed with Strahd, even though he's more powerful than Strahd because he's trying to preserve his body. He's the creature, which is one half of Strahd, with the other being the alchemist. We won't even get into why Strahd split, but he is the creature's most powerful and least trusted ally. He's got the sweeping black cape with red lining and other items similar to Strahd's, but he is basically just trying to lure... He's the distraction that keeps vampire hunters away from Strahd. He's basically, in a way, his lackey, even though in a one-on-one battle, Aslan could probably take Strahd.
Yeah.
We mean probably.
Yeah.
He would stomp his butt into the ground.
Yes. He would take Strahd. If he didn't think Strahd had a chance of helping him preserve his body, he would have already done away with him.
He would say, Strahd, kiss my butt. Come on. Come here. Now.
Yeah.
Do it.
Wow. Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Nick, you've acted this out, I see, huh?
Yes.
Maybe? Maybe not.
But yeah, so he's, I would say, the most powerful lich you will find in first edition outside of the guy at the end of the Tomb of Horrors who's not really there.
Well, he's a demi-lich.
Yes. So,
Sarek.
Right. Yeah. Now, so he, we have that, him as a lich, but there, you can also have other liches as well, because they're also found in the monster manual as well.
Right.
So, and there's a Dragon Magazine article in issue 26 that actually talks about the process of becoming a lich, which when you read that, it actually conflicts with the actual monster manual, because in the article it states anyone over level 10 can become any magic user over level 10 can become a lich, but in the monster manual it says they have to be at least a level 18 magic user.
Yeah.
Or level something cleric, or I think I'm reading right.
Yeah. They could be either a magic user or a magic user cleric.
Right. So they contradict themselves in the Dragon Magazine. Wonderful.
Right.
Well, basically, the thing on that, now let me just stress, that's one of the articles that I did post on the forum and everything, was Gary Gygax's letter in White Dwarf Magazine, at which he was really, really being, what can I say, dismissive of the early Dragon magazines because they were not canon. Mm-hmm. So when it comes down to it, yes, always go with the Monster Manual. The early Dragon magazines were good, but again, they were not canon.
Right, they were always considered optional rules for the Dungeon Master to consider when playing the game. So the books are canon, Dragon magazines are not, but I think that reversed itself later on when that
is correct.
When Wizards took over, they started making Dragon magazines the correction to the books in the canon, so.
Right. Yeah, they started using Dragon magazine as the bi-monthly errata for their books.
And that is correct, and that's one thing good about the early Dragon magazines. They did provide a lot of good errata and all that. So don't get me wrong. Now, I love Dragon magazine. Imposes a lot of great things for a DM and some players who love to read it. But just remember, a good portion of it's not canon. But I always go with the Monster Manual.
Right. But this article, though, when it goes into detail of becoming a lich, you could even make a story out of trying to thwart someone becoming a lich.
Yep.
Because when you look at the ingredients required to become one for the potion they must drink, we got the blood of a dead humanoid infant killed by a phase spider, blood of a dead humanoid infant killed by a mixture of arsenic and belladonna, heart of a virgin humanoid killed by a Wyrm venom. I mean, one quart of blood from a vampire infected with vampirism. I mean, very specific stuff that all of a sudden babies are being kidnapped. Face spiders are disappearing from the local area.
Now, the arsenic and belladonna you can get a hold of rather easy.
Yes, that's fairly easy. But one measure of fresh Wyrm venom. One measure of fresh face spider venom.
Yes.
Oh, you
round up reproductive glands of 7 giant moths.
They're not in the local general store?
Dead for less than 60 days.
Less than 60 days.
Oh, I thought the general store sold those things.
When you have moth reproductive glands, they must be fresh.
Exactly. And nice. Even then, once they concoct this potion and drink it, they have a chance of it not working. So they might have to die. Right. Or it just doesn't work, at which point they have to get it all again.
Yep.
So liches should be rare just for the amount of effort required to be one. Because one, you have the requirement of being 18th level magic user. Then you have to get all these obscure rare things, mix them in a potion, drink it, hope it works, and hope you don't die in the process. Mm-hmm. So you shouldn't have like a whole country of liches. Just that would, albeit if you just start taking the Thay to their natural extension, they would all become liches at some point. But
the Commonwealth of Liches.
Yes.
Lichovia.
Lichovia, yeah.
So, have you guys used liches in your campaigns?
No, I've never used a lich at all. I never liked that monster to begin with.
You're kidding. No, oh, liches are awesome.
No, I've always been the siding with the whole Dracula, so.
Wow, that's impressive. I will tell you this, though. I am not a fan of the lich. I'm not a big fan of vampires either. My favorite undead creature are ghosts. I love ghosts, especially when I have human. Players playing human characters. I love ghosts. But, yeah, liches, definitely there's a couple. There's, I think two of them, or if not one of them in G, 1, 2, 3, or D, I'm sorry, it was D 1 and 2, Descend to the Depths of the Earth, where you run into that one nasty lich down there, and there's a vampire down there with a minion, or a succubus with them down there, if you remember those.
Yeah.
So I'm just remembering this from memory now.
The vampire with the succubus girlfriend.
There you go. And I know that lich.
There's
down
a
there.
Lich.
Yep.
In Descent to the Depths of the Earth, I think his lair has like all these magic mouths around it.
Yeah, that's so. Right. Because he's got some type of phantasmal force or invisibility thing covering where he lays in, and if he's disturbed, he gets out. He's kind of angry and everything. But yeah, so my encounters as a player are very rare with liches.
I thought, kind of a side note, it's a funny thing about that module in D1 and 2, where. A lich is an encounter, not the encounter of the module, but it's an encounter. So yeah. What does that tell you about that particular adventure? You know?
Oh, that's just insanity. Yeah, just a regular encounter, you can run into a lich, and I'm thinking, like, this is not right. Yeah. Especially if you see that fireball.
Oh, I love that. I mean, that's great. You're not just running into, like, little bugbears here, man. This is a lich. I like them. In fact, my current the previous campaign, which is now on hiatus until probably next year sometime.
Aww.
One of the things is in my game world, Vecna came back. Yes, Acerak. Yeah, Acerak was able to come back, or one of the ways he wanted to come back was to somehow get the hand and eye of Vecna, but once he acquired both of them, Vecna's soul took over Acerak's body, and now Vecna is loose in the game world and has carved out his own small kingdom.
Nice. So
there's a kingdom of like undead in my game world now where Vecna is the soul ruler.
And you know, that's very interesting that you bring that up and everything, because as you see the parallels with Azalin and Strahd, you can see the same thing with Vecna and his lieutenant. What was his name? Kos, I believe his name was?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Are you all familiar? Yeah,
that's the vampire later on.
I
disregard that. So,
I only bring that because that's in the DMG when you talk about the hand and eye of Vecna and everything.
Oh yeah, the Sword of Kos. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
there you go. That's what I'm talking about. I'm doing by the book stuff here, not like I normally do. But yes, I just like the analogy between Strahd and Azalin and Vecna and that vampire lieutenant that he had there that tried to kill him.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I almost forgot about that.
Yeah, but I'm glad you brought up Vecna. I love Vecna. I think that was, you know, I know we're not supposed to be talking about this, but Vecna is probably one of my more favorite dark lord of Ravenloft. I love it.
Well, he is a lich, if I recall correctly.
So. Well, actually, he was a lich, but then when it came to the second edition and everything, just to mention, I know, but I gotta, you know, get full-on gamer and all them guys over there, but he is a demigod in Ravenloft.
Yes, he's a demigod.
And he is, or a lesser god, a demigod or a lesser god, whichever one. Oh, yeah, it is a demigod, as a matter of fact. That is correct until the one module came out, Vecna Reborn. But, and he is furious. He's angry because he tries to assail, you know, the forces of the mist. And of course, he can't do it. And he's angry and he wants to punish them. I just loved it how they explained it when he was trapped there and how angry he was trying to get out.
You're kidding. Oh. He's actually a demigod?
In second edition, he is a demigod that is entrapped in Ravenloft. Yes, sir.
That is weird because in my game world, when Vecna came back, he became the demigod of the undead. I had no idea about all that other stuff you talked about.
Yes.
That is so weird.
Vecna played a big portion in Ravenloft because Chaos is there as well, too, and they're constantly battling each other. So it's just amazing how that story carries out. But just to give you an understanding, I don't want to break your heart, he eventually becomes a lesser god and forces Ravenloft to expel him. Ravenloft can only keep demigod status and below. Once he attained lesser god status, he forced Ravenloft to expel him.
Huh.
Interesting.
Those poor liches. I don't know. Those liches are having a rough life out there.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, I remember, I think it was last year, we had a bit of a discussion about, you know, who's more powerful, Strahd or Acerak or whatever lich. I'm like, I'm sorry. Liches are more powerful.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's when Jason and I were like, aha, we voted against you and you lost. So.
Yeah, that was just in spite of me, though. It's not a very accurate vote there.
Well, someone I remember emailed us in and said we should actually do a battle between the two of them, play it out round for round.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah, that'd be cool if we want to waste 3 hours on a podcast, though.
Yeah, and the main difference is the Lich could kill Strahd once, whereas Strahd would have to kill the Lich like 8 times.
Right.
That's Strahd. The main
difference. Strahd would still win. Strahd's my boy. I know it.
No, all the Lich would have to do is make an attractive blonde, say it's Tatiana, and he'd go all emo, and he'd be distracted
there you go.
And kill him.
I thought you were going to say Buffy.
Get all, like, emo vampire and...
Oh, which actually, that'd be an interesting plot hook for Ravenloft if you had a female player. Make her the reincarnation...
Strahd sparkle in the sunlight, too?
Yes, he can't. Once he sees Tatiana, he probably does. But what you do is you make the one of your female player characters the reincarnation of Tatiana.
As a matter of fact, since you brought that up, during the Fortunes of Ravenloft, that is a possibility with the storyline.
Oh.
If you look on
in the sunlight?
Oh, no. No. Actually, what happens is during the Fortunes of Ravenloft, Strahd has a goal. And I think that one of those goals, if I'm correct, I didn't look at it, I'm just sitting here talking, listening, is that he thinks that one of the female players in the party is a reincarnation of that girl. So that's just a thought, just to let you know that you brought that up.
What happens if no female players in the party?
Strahd is emo. Strahd is emo, and then he thinks one of the males is. No, I'm just giving you a hard time. No. Eventually... What's the name? Does join the party.
Ah, okay.
I should be saying all this stuff and everything because eventually you see how this all connects one way or another.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I just think, like, pound for pound, you compare a lich to a vampire, a lich is going to whoop a vampire's butt. The exception might be Strahd because he does have magic using ability. I think it would be a tough battle.
Standard vampire versus standard lich?
Standard vampire versus standard lich.
Oh, yeah, the lich would probably win.
Lich, definitely.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Now, like, if you take, like, if you take Strahd and then, like, I don't know, Acerak, I think it would be a pretty tough battle.
Right, with Strahd coming out the victor, of course.
Oh. Yeah, and he sparkles in the sunlight. Ha, there you go.
He does not sparkle in the sunlight. This is not the Twilight Saga movies.
Thank God for that.
Ruining vampires forever, those movies. God.
Yes. I do say to my oldest daughter, she did like the Twilight books and everything, and I always say to her, vampires don't sparkle in the sunlight. They're blood-sucking hell beasts that should be killed. Okay? She's like, no!
No, because they're cute and they have to be loved.
No, they're blood-sucking hell beasts that should be killed.
Okay, so let's head into Dragon Swords since we're way off topic. Now talking about Twilight and We Shall Be Shot.
Okay.
Did me not tell you that my thief's character that I'm playing now in that Skype is named Cullen?
Well, I'm disconnecting you from the podcast now.
And on that high note...
As the secret portal yields to your efforts, you stand amazed at a vision from the most fevered dreams of avarice. Before you lies the Dragon's Hoard.
All right, on to the Dragon's Hoard. And I almost forgot about this particular magic item. This is out of I-6 Ravenloft, and it's the holy symbol of Ravenkind. And what it is... It's an ancient platinum medallion that was once worn by the High Priest of Ravenloft. It is a powerful, lawful good symbol. And this is like it's a disc shaped like the sun, large crystal embedded in the center. There's all these holy symbols of light and truth around the sun. And when any cleric presents this medallion in front of any sort of undead, I would almost qualify that any good cleric or any lawful cleric, any good cleric. But it says, when presented forcibly towards any undead creature, a medallion adds +2 to the cleric's turn undead roll.
Pretty cool. Oh, that's cool.
Now, when presented against vampires, however, it flares with the light of the sun for 1 to 10 rounds. And remember, vampires are destroyed by exposure to direct sunlight for 10 rounds.
Or sparkle.
No, they don't sparkle. They burn. Vampires cannot move or attack while the medallion flares. Other creatures are not affected by the medallion. The medallion can only be used once per week. So that's the holy symbol of Ravenkind. Now, pretty useful magic item, though only can be used once per week. Though, I don't understand why. I mean, it's not that powerful.
I might change that for a campaign, especially in Ravenloft.
Yeah, I would say if you want... And can you take this out of Ravenloft? Absolutely. I would say you could maybe name it something else. But I would maybe change this item up a little bit. You'd still have the +2 versus undead on this turn undead roll. But I would also, you know, when used against vampires and other negative plane creatures, I would say it has that sun flare for 1 to 10 rounds. Mm-hmm. Not only just vampires, I would say it'd be useful against wraiths and other creatures from the negative material plane. So I don't know. I think it's a pretty cool magic item. I don't know what you would give for XP value for something like that. If it's, I mean, it's not really an artifact. I don't see it as too much of an artifact in itself. I just don't see it as that powerful.
No, it's not powerful at all. It's just pretty useful for a cleric. That's all.
Yeah, it's pretty useful. I mean, the +2 for turning undead. That's cool bonus. Love that. Great. Use against vampires. 1 to 10 rounds. You know, basically slows them down. That's pretty cool, too. But only used once per week? Nah. I don't know. Maybe once a day? I would be good with that.
Yeah, I'd tweak it a little bit and make it an equivalent to, say, like the Holy Avenger for a paladin.
Yeah, that would be really good. And that's why I also said, like, you know, against vampires and other negative plane creatures, it can use that sunburst thing.
Yeah. Well, see, my problem with this is, being that this is a one-shot module and everything, and how they designed it, I think it's an extremely overpowered item. Okay, because specifically on... Oh, yes, definitely, especially... this is what's going to happen with this kind of item. I mean, you're not going to be scared of vampires anymore. I wouldn't be scared of a vampire again if I had this item, because if you look, it says specifically that, remember, that vampires are destroyed by exposure to direct sunlight for 10 rounds. Vampires cannot move or attack while the medallion flares. You would not have to worry about vampires again for the rest of the time you play AD&D with this item.
For one to 10 rounds, though. What if it only works for, like, one round? Then what do you do?
But you have a 10% chance of destroying any vampire just by sticking this thing in front of them, including Strahd.
Right.
Okay.
All right. See, this is what I'm saying when people say that, you know, don't get me wrong, Strahd is a nasty bad guy, but this module was designed to where you can easily defeat him with no problems, and so, you know, he's not really as powerful as people make him out to be. And again, when this thing flares, vampires cannot move or attack, which means, tells me now, he's practically defenseless, and you can stake him. Or whatever you want to do to them, you know, get everyone prepared so that when the flare goes away. Now, if you made it to where, well, you don't know how long the flare is going to last. Yeah, now we're going to make this a weaker item. This is a very dangerous item in the hands of a good party. It makes undead almost, I can't say it makes them weaker, but this is a very powerful item.
Well, I would never tell the players how long the sunburst lasts anyway. I would roll behind the screen and say the vampire is now frozen.
Yeah, I would leave it once per week. If you're going to use it, I'd leave it at once per week. This is a one-shot thing, or, you know, this is item was made specifically by divine beings, what have you, you know, to destroy Strahd or make him defenseless to where the party can destroy him, whatever the case may be. But, yeah, that's a very powerful ability, especially against a vampire. That eliminates them pretty much, even if it's just one round. Okay. The vampires can't move or attack or whatever. What are you all going to do? Oh, I'm staking them.
How about if maybe like dropping it down to 1d4 rounds and giving them use twice a day?
It's tough to say. I would have to really look at it. I'm a big stickler on powerful magic items that do this kind of these things.
I just don't see it that powerful a magic item. No, I don't.
Especially if you're going to be playing in a world where there's a lot of vampires, I don't see why it would.
Oh yeah, I can imagine that. Right. I'm just
looking at in Ravenloft itself, yes, powerful magic item. But if you took that magic item out into Forgotten Realms or World of Greyhawk fantasy campaign setting, not that powerful.
Right.
Sorry to say,
not useful that anymore. Unless you're running down dead all the time.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a thing. I like my undead to be universally feared,
right,
regardless of what they have in their possession. Yeah. And it's just that, you know, just the fact that you have an item now that can practically stun a vampire, right, and you can do anything you want. I think it's a little overpowering, and I would be very, you know, limited on how they would use it.
What if you gave the undead a saving throw against the paralyzation? So you would still get the +2 to turn, but give them some sort of saving throw to avoid being paralyzed, or maybe they're paralyzed for half of the duration.
That's up to
yeah.
Again, like I said, I think it's just a very powerful item.
The module itself, it is.
How about this?
But not outside of it. It just isn't. It's not that powerful outside of Ravenloft. If I plop this in the Forgotten Realms or World of Greyhawk, I mean, taken with the whole campaign world at large, it is not that powerful a magic item.
Right.
Oh, yeah, I can see where you come from. Yeah,
absolutely.
Because there's other things out there more powerful than vampires, like we said, like liches and dragons and...
other
things out there, too.
So. I got a super vampire against your lich.
Super vampire? Was he have like a big S on his chest?
Yes, he does.
I'm super vampire.
He can fly. See,
you know,
I
you could
still
also have...
flip him with garlic. So.
See, you could always create vampires that, you know, may be immune to the effects of the you know, the medallion or what have you.
Make a daywalker vampire that can go out in sunlight.
Of course. I mean, you know, that's the possibility.
Oh, don't go there. Don't go there. Why did you do that?
You wanted this magic item. Now you're going to pay for it. Now you're going
to I'm going to have to like reach that through the line and strangle you. Vampire person.
But it's actually, you know what, when it's compared to the sun sword, yeah, I think I would let them have the holy symbol before I let them have that sun sword.
Hmm.
Yeah, because remember, when you swing that sun sword in there, that it flares just like that holy symbol. And guess what? You can swing it for 10 rounds, and there it goes. That's an instant vampire killer right there. So, yeah, it's not as powerful as the sun sword. So you can have your little holy symbol.
Yeah, true. Okay, and that'll probably conclude the dragon sword. And let's head into our last segment of the night.
Construction.
The Adventure Construction. Remember this segment, guys?
Predates me.
Predates Matt, predates Will. Nick remembers it.
I do?
Yeah, we had this a couple times with Jason.
We did?
Yeah. This week we're going to... Who? What? You know, that other guy that used to sit in the other chair?
Oh, yeah. Him. Okay.
We're going to talk about this week a little bit. We'll just open a discussion about how to, as a DM, roleplay the forces of darkness and evil in Ravenloft, the powers that be that suck you in and notice the party. Now, Will, you're an expert on Ravenloft as far as using the powers that be that notice the party.
Right.
So how would you give a tip to a DM how to roleplay that?
Well, I mean, as I stated earlier in the podcast and everything, that the whole... The Ravenloft is a living entity. It's right. A malevolent, that it could be a negative life force, whatever. It's a life force that is malevolent. It's full of hatred. It's just everything that could be considered evil, probably worse than that.
Is it icky? My drift.
Oh, well, yeah, definitely.
Then it's evil.
But it definitely it's of a malevolent nature that is extremely powerful. I mean, if it's to the point where it starts interfering with the clerical spells, you know, because, you know, clerics get their spells from gods, and if it has that power to actually do those kind of things, yes, it's just a horrible entity. That's how I would role play. I mean, I role play, but that's how I would rule as what is the defining force of Ravenloft overall. It's just a living entity that seeks out evil people when they do an evil deed at that point.
Yeah. I may even give players bonuses after committing an evil deed, so they become a little more powerful for every bit of evil they do. Just to show that the domain is actually taking more of an interest into them and eventually hit the point where the domain's actually corrupting them. Kind of like the dark side of the Force in Star Wars.
I would make the supreme ruler of the realm Pennywise the Clown out of Ed.
Oh, boy.
I did not like that. I didn't like it.
That's why I would do... No, I'm kidding. I wouldn't do that. But yeah,
sure.
I don't know. I guess that as far as like incorporating Ravenloft, I think I would just incorporate into the campaign world, like I said, as some principality or barony, and I don't know if the land itself is like a malevolent force. I guess I could do it that way. I think I would tie it more into, Strahd being the malevolent force, and he's the one who's corrupting the land itself. But
definitely, I agree with you on that. I think Strahd should have some saying. Again, Strahd is the domain lord. It's his land, so he knows what's going on, whether it's him or his minions, because understand, Strahd knows what's going on with the wolves, the bats. He has his resources, and plus he's got the Vistani there, the gypsies.
Right. I guess you look at it as, is Strahd the corrupter of the land, or is the land the actual corrupter of Strahd and the people around it? You know, I guess you can, you know, it depends on which is more, what's your own personal angle on it.
And just understand, use the history of Strahd to make that definite definition of how you're going to make this land. Because remember, Strahd is cursed. He wasn't bitten by a vampire. He was cursed because he committed an evil act.
You watched Highlander 2 and enjoyed it.
Or Halloween 3.
Yeah.
double feature night.
Blah.
Watch both.
I was always, you know, using the forces of darkness as pretty much like the dark side of the force, tempting and always like Matt said, tempting and always wanting the player to come over to their side, watching them and giving them chances to prove themselves. What, Matt?
They have cookies.
They have cookies, right?
Yeah.
You ever seen that T-shirt? So I have a friend of mine who says, well, come to the dark side. We have cookies.
I like cookies. Cookies are good.
Yeah. Yes. Does Evil Strahd cookies. Have cookies?
Uh-huh. No, Strahd does not have cookies. He's not a banker.
Strahd the baker.
Well, he was an alchemist. Why can't he be a baker?
Why not? Never
know. You come to my castle, I give you cookies. You may be poisoned, but I give you cookies.
Bake sale at Castle Ravenloft.
Oh, jeez.
And, of course, where the cookies are in the middle of the castle is the Jabba!
The Jabba!
The Jabba!
Oh, no. It's not a tumor.
All right. Well, that was pretty much going to be the show in a nutshell. So, any guys have any last parting words?
Liches are more powerful than vampires. Even and Strahd.
Clerics only use blunt weapons.
Now, you know, you can't just throw that out there. It has nothing to do with what we're talking. Well, maybe a little. But
we'd like to hear how you use Ravenloft and maybe how you guys have made a Ravenloft setting or kind of a creepy horror or gothic thing for your campaigns. Maybe you didn't even bother with Ravenloft or you just made up something on your own. I'd like to hear it. So email us, rfistaff@gmail.com. Give us a call, 570-425-8210, the hotline. And I'll conclude the show. Keep it original, keep it old school, and good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Take care.
Roll for initiative.